Shumrabyug.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Shurlook, Shurlisten, the podcast that takes a pop at culture.
Shurlook,
Shurlisten.
Shurlook, Shurlisten.
Shurlook, Shurlisten.
Shurlook, Shurlisten.
Shurlook, Shurlisten.
Shurlook, Shurlisten.
Shurlook, Shurlisten.
Oh, very good there, Cynthia. You've put a bit of extra spice on the intro this week. This is why we don't just pre-record that intro, to let you put some extra spice into it every week. But your look, Cynthia, we don't have time to get it into you because we've loads of stuff to look at, including The Crow. There's a new The Crow and he's a slim, muscular man. And we've got a couple of trailers for The Watchers. Who watches The Watchers, Benjamin? Probably us.
Aye.
And the film, which I didn't think this was the real name of it, but it is, I Saw the TV Glow. And you haven't, but I have seen the cinematic experience of the year, Dune 2, Mix Review.
Yeah, mixed review, very important. I like the way you read the running order completely there, Michael, as opposed to just announcing that you have a review of Dune 2. He is the equivalent. He's the Irish podcasting equivalent of Ron from Anchorman. He will read whatever you put on the running order in front of him, ladies and gentlemen.
Read anything, as long as it's not racist or misogynistic. That's why we have Ben.
That's why we have me. I take care of all those sections. Shurlisten, ladies and gentlemen, if that wasn't enough to run it's probably not. We're a bit sparse on content this week, but we'll make it work, Michael. We'll make it work. We're also taking a look at Wolverine versus Sabretooth, a feud as old as time. What's going on there? Where did it start in the comic book annals of history?
Mm.
And why is it the central focus of the current Wolverine run?
Well, I've got some answers for you then.
Oh, very good, very good, very good. Michael!
Benjamin, before any of that, though, if any listeners are listening, and they want to go directly to any of those things, there's time codes in the descriptions below, so they can just click down onto them and say, I want to hear about Wolverine and Sabretooth and their history. So I'm going to go down and I'm going to click on the time code that Mick very thoughtfully put in the description, rather than not doing that, listening to the whole thing, and then complaining that the whole thing wasn't about Wolverine and Sabretooth.
Listen, ladies and gentlemen, if you enjoy that kind of careful consideration of listeners and their time, maybe you would consider giving us a review wherever you listen. We're all over the place. We're on Spotify, we're on Acast, we're on bloody Apple Podcasts, ladies and gentlemen. And Mick sent me a very exciting text during the week, and it was 5 stars on Spotify, and it had the number 13 next to it. So 13 of you have gone and given us a review.
Hooray!
Thank you very much.
Hooray!
Glad
we waited 7 years to ask people to do that, but at least the 13 people who reviewed it gave us 5 stars, Benjamin. So
we really appreciate it, ladies and gentlemen. If you'd like Mick to text me at the beginning of next week with another update, go give us a review wherever you listen.
5 stars though, because we're on track now. We don't want to go off track.
Don't want to be besmirched, ladies and gentlemen. Michael, I tell you what else I woke up to.
What did you wake
this
up to?
Week, and this is going to alienate at least 3 of our listeners when I say this, Michael. I'm looking forward to it. I woke up to a bunch of fully grown men complaining that their edgelord from the 90s wasn't as edgy or lordy as they remember.
Benjamin, men in their mid-40s are very upset this week. Men in their mid-40s are very upset about what has happened to their boy, Eric Draven.
Now, come here to me.
What?
Come here to me. To the men that are in their 40s and are very upset about this, who listen to us, this is a joke. It's comedic.
I don't know if it is.
We're not having a go at anyone. I'm having a full go at everyone,
yeah,
Michael.
Yeah, yeah.
But I've come out swinging this week. Michael, we're getting a reboot of The Crow.
Oh, good, Ben. Because what we really need was the reboot of a series which already had terribly diminishing returns.
Yeah, look, The Crow is more infamous in history than it is a classic of any kind.
I can hear the lynch nooses tightening. They're going to come
for you. That's why I asked people to give... Yeah, maybe I shouldn't have asked for the review.
Yeah, ask for the review before you have a go at The Crow.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you find a pit of ire fizzing in your buns, you can hop up on the Discord and let me know directly. That's where everybody bullies me. So you can hop up there. It's linked below in the description. But Michael, this film, well, it's based on a comic book, first of all, Michael. The Crow is, I guess you'd call it a superhero comic?
Yeah. Supernatural superhero, yeah.
Yeah. Supernatural superhero. And it comes from creator James O'Barr.
Oh, yeah. Well, what did he create? The Crow.
Yeah. He created The Crow, and that's about it. Now, he's done a few other things here and there, Michael, but he's Eric Draven, and the comic itself was published in 1989. The first issue debuted from Caliber Comics in 1989, but it's a bit sad. It's James O'Barr's way of dealing with the trauma of actually losing his fiancée to a drunk driver. So this, in many ways, was a cathartic comic book for James O'Barr. And it helps him deal with his own trauma. But what he essentially did, Michael, was create the edgelord of all edgelords.
Benjamin, he's got white face paint and triangles over his eyes. And he hasn't got a shirt on. And he's got long hair and a guitar. And, Benjamin, leather trousers.
Yeah, it's pretty good, like. It's pretty good.
So, Benjamin, you're coming in here mocking as though...
Yeah.
You were 4 when The Crow came out, Ben, and you're completely the wrong demographic.
No, I wasn't.
How old were you?
I wasn't alive.
The movie.
Oh, the movie. I was 3.
3. Okay, very good.
2, in fact.
And look, you weren't going, oh, look, I like that man's leather trousers and he's got no shirt on. I am 3 and my name is Little Benjamin. You weren't saying that. But Benjamin, all of the boys who were 15 when that came out... That was the coolest thing that had ever happened. Because Benjamin, he was vengeance, and he was serious and emotional, and he had a guitar.
Yes. Brandon Lee brought all the boys to the yard, and they're like, my crow's better than yours, damn right. It's better than yours, I could teach you, but I'd have to murder people in vengeance.
Yeah, that's kind of what he's about. So anyway, Benjamin, look, the reason that the lads are all upset... in the year of our Lord 2024, is it's not Brandon Lee anymore. It's now Bill Skarsgård.
Yeah, so it can't be Brandon Lee, first of all, Michael, because he tragically passed away while filming this very film.
One of the reasons that the film became so infamous, in fact.
Yes, infamous as opposed to good. But anyway, come here to me. Now, Michael, we got a picture of Bill Skarsgård, and some comparisons have been made, Michael.
To Jared Leto's The Joker.
To Jared Leto's The Joker, which is not a good thing to be compared to at any point.
Because that was rubbish.
It'd be like comparing your podcast co-host to me. It's just not a favourable comparison.
No.
But look, I'm going to pick... Three-year-old Ben's having a field day here, because I'm going to say, Michael, not that much of a difference. It's not that different. I've seen it. If anything, Bill Skarsgård is possibly in better shape. Because I don't know if you know this, Michael, but Bill Skarsgård just gets ripped for everything now.
Just gets ripped for everything. He's got the Skarsgård genes. We've talked about this before.
We have. Boy Kills World. We reviewed it last week.
He's ripped in that as well.
He's just ripped as fuck.
Two men talking about Bill Skarsgård being ripped podcast. But this
been
time he's ripped.
Ripped as fuck.
This time he's ripped and he's got Jared Leto style tattoos. But look, Ben... There's men in their 40s now who they're in the vapors because of all the things you've just said there.
They're foaming at the mouth. Yeah.
This is like, Benjamin, if someone comes along in 20 years and says that the thing that you love wasn't great.
Luckily, Michael, having done this podcast for 7 years, I love nothing. it's all over.
You're safe then. You're emotionally secure.
I'm emotionally secure by having burned it all out of me, Michael. No, I suppose, Michael,
what?
The equivalent of this would be if someone remade The Boys and rather than, I don't know, Homelander was played by someone, but he was made to be... Gothy, I don't know. What's the equivalent
here? Well, Benjamin,
you can't predict it.
If you could predict it, you would be a multimillionaire.
Yeah, I'd be upset anyway, Michael. I wouldn't enjoy the performance.
Yeah. You're going to be very upset when they reboot Harry Potter.
I'm not. I can't stand those films.
Huge Harry Potter fan. Huge Harry Potter fan and transphobe, famously Ben Colopy. Anyway, Benjamin.
That's me. That's me.
Might as well chuck another one in there now that we've got you to admit to misogyny and sexism.
I'm a homophobe. I'm a misogynist. I'm a transphobe now, apparently.
Hang him in
there. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to vote for what I should hate with no rational explanation next, we'll put a poll in the Discord this week. You can hop up on it and give us a vote.
Yeah, we won't. Ben, speaking of things, though, that you irrationally hate, we got a trailer this week. Although you wouldn't know it, for the most Irish horror film that's ever Irished. Although, from the trailer, you wouldn't know it.
You wouldn't know it. It certainly didn't come across as Irish to me, but it is. It's The Watchers, Michael. And M. Night Shyamalan is back.
He's back, Benjamin. We can't get rid of him. Look, he's very successful. He's a very successful man, and he's made a very successful daughter, and that daughter is going to direct this film for us.
Yes? Is that what's happening?
Yes, yeah. It's his daughter is the director.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm mistaken that. I really apologise to M. Night Shyamalan's daughter. What's her name?
Isaiah?
I think I just saw Shyamalan and saw Red, ladies and gentlemen.
You did
that
see
must have been
M.
What
Night
happened
Shyamalan, because M. Night Shyamalan's the producer and his name is first, I think.
Oh, no, you're right. It's Ishana Night Shyamalan.
Yeah, I know.
Ishana is her name. And Michael, it's based on a bloody Irish horror novel.
It's very much based on an Irish horror novel, Benjamin, by A.M. Shine, or Mr. Sunshine, Morning Sunshine, as we call him here. And...
Yes, a Morning Sunshine.
A Morning Sunshine. Benjamin, it's...
Yes.
It's another in the classic genre of don't you go anywhere near Bray.
Oh, Bray, no fucking good.
It's terrifying. Bray and thereabouts, Benjamin. We've encountered Bray and thereabouts so many times recently on this podcast as the setting for Irish horror, and they've done it again.
Yeah, so look, we've covered this extensively on the podcast, Michael. We have a few episodes on some great Irish-based forest horrors, especially. We covered The Hallow for our Halloween specials this year, and we covered The Hole in the Woods.
Hole in the Ground.
Hole in the Ground, even, if you're good at accurate things. Mm. But both terrifying films set in Wicklow.
Bray and thereabouts, the most terrifying place on earth.
Bray and thereabouts.
Don't go there.
Don't go to Wicklow.
Don't go anywhere near Bray. Benjamin, our very good friend, your friend and mine, Stephen Cadwell, has a new horror music album coming out called Bray. Now, I think he should name it Bray or thereabouts, because it is, in fact, the most terrifying place on earth.
Maybe it's the not knowing the limits of Bray. Maybe it's the liminal quality that Bray holds. Where does it end? Where does it begin? Mm. We don't know. But that seems to be the theme of The Watchers, Michael, because it is about a liminal space that traps people in it. It's a forest that isn't charted on any map. And it has that classic supernatural conceit that if you try and work machinery or drive a car through it, they just stop working.
You end up
stranded. And that's what happens to Mina, who is the main character of this, who looks to be played by Dakota Fanning.
It is Dakota Fanning, yes.
Yes, looks to be played. But we don't know if it's... I think it's Mina who she's playing in this. And it centres around a bizarre bunker that functions as kind of a stage.
Mm, or a TV in a way. Like a one-way screen.
Oh, very good, Michael. I didn't even put that together.
Or a cinema screen. They're like actors and they're getting a round of applause from the weird creatures outside. And those weird creatures, Benjamin, you might think that they're the metaphor for the audience, but it's not. It's just people from Bray.
What are they? It's just lads from Bray trapping people in big spaces. Yeah, that's about right. Yeah, so this is very interesting, Michael. So basically, they're forced to perform at nightfall, and the big thing becomes a two-way screen, and they're watched by the Watchers, as it's put. I don't know if it's a commentary on our culture of assessing talent based on massive performance-based review. Like America's Got Talent or American Idol or Britain's Got Talent or one of the talents.
Mm. Look, Benjamin, we probably would have had a better idea if we'd read the book, but I've been busy reading The Three Body Problem for the last couple of weeks, so I haven't read it. I haven't read The Watchers.
Yeah. I've been busy ducking existential dread in most places, Michael. But very interesting, Michael. It has another kind of Irish export in there. Alwyn, and I always get her name wrong, Foray is her name. She's the older woman there with the jet white hair, Michael. She pops up all over the place, Michael. And she's half Bretonish and half Irish.
Oh, get out of here, is she?
She's a visual artist who does a lot of acting. She was recently in The Tourist with Jamie Dornan.
Oh, was that any use or was that set in Bray and thereabouts?
It's not in Bray or thereabouts. It's in Ireland thereabouts. Oh. It's pretty solid stuff.
Sounds terrifying.
Pretty great stuff all round. But come here to me.
Go on.
Looks very, very creepy and Shyamalan-y, doesn't it?
Yeah, very. That's pretty much it, yeah.
We're going to play my favourite game now, Michael. And that is, what's the twist in Shyamalan's latest venture? Now, I realise, Michael, that we're going to have to slightly jig the game up, as it were, because Ishana Knight Shyamalan is the director here. So, what's the Shyamalan dynasty's latest twist?
We can probably read the book and find out.
No, I probably won't do that. Well, no, I will, actually. If A.M. Shine would like to come on and take some guesses at what the twist might be. come on, and play the game.
Get him on and get him to go have a couple of rounds of what have they done to your baby?
Yeah, what have they done to your baby? Which is a classic game here on the podcast. But it looks suitably disturbing and creepy. And sure, I'm just delighted that we're going to get about another 20 to 25 years of Shyamalaning in one form or another. I'm delighted.
Look, Benjamin, it's a combination of Shyamalan and Bray. You can't go wrong. But...
you can't go wrong.
I'll tell you what you also can't go wrong with.
Go on.
The poster for the movie I Saw the TV Glow, which I thought was some sort of documentary series about the production of the film Poltergeist.
That's what I also thought when I first saw it, Michael. And then I saw A24 and I went, oh, no. And then I saw the A24 and said, oh, no, it's a subversion of genre brought to you by A24.
Fucking A24. Leave the genres alone, A24.
Stop subverting my expectations.
I thought this was just going to be a bloody horror movie about the production of the film Poltergeist and all of the things that went wrong behind it.
It was pretty rough by all accounts, Michael. Pretty rough by all accounts. But no, that's not what we're getting at all, Michael. In a twist of fate, Michael, this seems to be an original production. Not based on a novel.
Weird.
I did want to say on the previous one, A.M. Shine's The Watchers only came out in 2022. So we're now seeing a 1 year turnover cycle between novel and movie. To which I'm saying, Michael, we should write a novel.
Get it turned into a movie. It's so easy these days, apparently.
Apparently. So I Saw the Glow, Michael, is a pretty weird one. It's playing on that kind of childhood love of television. It's playing on the weird parasocial relationships that we build up between our favourite TV shows and fandoms. You know, there's a lot going on here. It's Justice Smith who's in it. Who's everywhere. He's everywhere.
Benjamin, you might remember him from Pokemon.
You might remember him from Pokemon. You might remember him from Dungeons and Dragons.
He was Philip the Useless Wizard.
Yes, he was. He was awful.
Simon. Philip is my wizard.
He was Simon. Yes, Philippe Lapps is your wizard, and he is truly useless. if you'd like to know more about that, ladies and gentlemen, you can hop up on the Discord and ask us directly.
Yeah.
So there you go. This has a few different people in it, Michael. Not many who would be household names, Justice Smith being possibly the biggest name on the casting. But then we have Bridget Lundy Payne, Michael, who's a bit of a scream queen in her own right. She pops up all over the place. The last thing we might have seen her in was Bill and Ted Face the Music.
All right. Ben, doesn't matter who's in it, as long as Fred Durst isn't in it.
All right.
Here's the funny thing about it, though.
That's mean. Right? Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, we could just read names to each other all as long as the day is long, but I don't know any of these people. Do you?
I like that podcast conceit where we just read IMDb's to each other.
I
think that's very romantic. But no, that's fair enough. Go on, tell me more.
I tell you what, though. I was watching this, Benjamin, and the first 25 or 30 seconds of it seems to be about kids who grew up in the olden days and sat in front of TVs. Now, these kids are too too young. The actors in this are too young to have grown up sitting on this floor in front of small CRT TV screens. But look, we'll ignore that conceit because the writers probably did. But the central premise of this, of a half-remembered children's TV show that was very influential on people growing up, I and you, as I can now see from your notes, and every other person who's terminally online, instantly thought this was a Candle Cove movie.
Yeah, I thought it was another adaptation of the creepypasta Candle Cove, which we've talked about before on this podcast, Michael. Very horrific wee horror story. Why don't you explain to people what creepypasta is for those who go outside and touch grass more often than we do?
Fucking grass touchers. Creepypasta, Benjamin, are short-form horror stories that people copy and paste, often in the form of like, oh, I heard this urban legend, or here's something I found on a message board. And they copy and paste it, and that's why it's called a pasta, copy pasta, and then it's a horror story, so it's a creepy pasta. Anyway, one of the most famous is Candle Cove, which is presented.
Yeah, but
go on.
No, no, go ahead. You're doing great.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Benjamin, because that's what I mean.
I meant that.
Reassurance from the likes of you. Anyway, Candle
Cove. I don't know where this tension is coming from this week. It's I don't know what's going on.
Candle
I don't know
Cove.
What I've done.
Candle Cove is a creepypasta from, I don't know, what, probably about 15 years ago. And it was presented in the form of kind of nostalgia about, hey, do you remember this kid's TV show that I can't find anything about these days?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Increasingly more and more people in a specific area remember seeing it. But as more and more people remember seeing it, the details of it get horrific. And if I remember correctly, it starts off as like a light-hearted thing with pirate puppets. And then there's some sort of horrible monster that eats children in it. And there's episodes where everything starts to break down and it's just puppets screaming and children crying. And
absolutely,
if I remember correctly, Benjamin, the twist of Candle Cove is that it didn't exist. It's some sort of terrifying shared hallucination or something like that.
So you're not a million miles off. First of all, it's a really fascinating use of the creepypasta format because it's designed in the style of old internet forum message boards. Mm. So it's a bunch of people who have come onto the fictional Net Nostalgia forum, and they are messaging each other back and forth, trying to track down whether or not this famous children's program for them ever existed. It's called Candle Cove, and it was on a specific channel, Channel 58.
Yes.
And it was in the Huntington Ashland metropolitan area when there were children in the early 1970s. So it was kind of a typical riff on your Muppets, on Sesame Street, on those programs that rose to prominence using puppets as a major form of children's education. Mm. And they talk about the great details of the show in the beginning, and then they begin to reminisce about a character called the Skin Taker, Michael.
Oh, he doesn't sound great.
He doesn't sound ideal. He was a skeleton pirate who wears clothing made out of children's skin.
Mm, warm and waterproof.
Warm and waterproof. Very functional. But yes, what happened was that there was, as with many of those shows, there was a human-centered protagonist at the center of the show, and that was Janice in the Candle Cove show. And then she dies. The final episode is her dying with puppets and screaming. And she dies off screen, but it's heavily implied that the Skin Taker takes her skin.
Ugh, gross.
As you would. So one of the users in this debate goes and gets in touch with his elderly mother who's in a nursing home. And he asks, do you remember me watching Candle Cove in the 70s? Like, was that a thing that I did? And she turns around and says, no, you used to sit down in front of a TV screen that was only static and watch that for hours at a time.
Benjamin, but this isn't about that at all.
Yes.
Massive diversion aside.
It's not. We took that opportunity to give you a little bit of information on a classic creepypasta there, ladies and gentlemen. No, this is about Owen, and Owen is struggling in his life in the suburbs, and he's a bit of an outcast, and he's a bit of a classic movie loser, I suppose, in that very contrived conceit way of, you know, he's ostracized in a very almost cartoonish way for the purposes of this, and then he is introduced to a mysterious late night TV show. And it's kind of again, the show is, it's a bit like Animorphs from the 1990s. It seems to be a little bit like Supernatural, the TV show, or Captain Planet. It's about a bunch of teenagers who are bonded by a power set that they can access, and it's accessed by glowing symbols. But then Owen's version of reality starts to break down. He seems to start believing that he was part of this show.
Awesome.
Yeah, and the trailer very much ends with us wondering if the suburbs that he now occupies are the fictional reality, or, you know, was he one of these things? Or is he the villain of the show? I think that's heavily implied in the trailer. There seems to be, very much in the vibe of The Skin Taker from Candle Cove, there seems to be a very evil, macabre, unnerving villain in what is essentially a children or teens TV show that doesn't really belong.
Excellent.
Yeah, so I think it's funny, because we see that a lot, Michael. That's become a really established trope. It's like one of these things is not like the other when it comes to children's TV shows or teen TV shows. And there's a lot of content being made now out of, you know, this is supposed to be a fun thing, but actually this really sinister figure exists within that universe. And I think there's a lot of writers today working out some trauma from when they were kids.
Yeah, and they actually watched fucking Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. And the Child Catcher has been after them ever since.
Exactly. And they're now using that, and it's emerging as its own thing. We didn't talk about this, Michael, because we didn't get a chance. But this is very much in the vibe of a new kind of 80s pastiche thing that's going on.
Go on.
I don't know if you saw the trailer for David Dastmalchian's new film that's going to be coming out.
Last Voyage of the Demeter?
No, Last Voyage of the Demeter is very good, and everybody should check that out as soon as they can. But this one is Late Night with the Devil, Michael. Have you seen the trailer for this?
I haven't. How did we skip this?
I don't know how we missed it. I think we forgot to put it on the running order. But Late Night with the Devil, this is not a recent trailer, ladies and gentlemen. It does look very interesting. So for anybody who doesn't know, David Dastmalchian, it plays a lot of odd horror B-movie characters. He enjoys that genre. He's very much part of it. He's most famously been the Polka Dot Man in the Suicide Squad reboot from James Gunn. And he is, yeah, he's an all-round good character actor. But he plays a Johnny Carson-esque 80s TV show host. Not unlike Robert De Niro's character in the Joker film.
Oh, yeah.
He's playing that kind of character. And this comes to us from our friends over at Shudder, Michael.
Oh, good.
Making some of the creepiest stuff. Mm. Grand bunch of lads. If Shudder would like to sponsor this podcast, please do.
Or just send Ben horror.
Please just give us.
Send Ben unsolicited horror. He loves that.
I love that. That's my favourite thing. It doesn't keep me awake at night at all.
Bang it up on the Dropbox.
So, yeah. So he plays this, and he has a series of what you would, I suppose, call typical late night guests from the 80s. So there's a mentalist, there's a spoon bender, there's a comedian and stuff. But each one of them goes horribly wrong. And something very supernatural is happening in the studio, and people are being possessed. There's a medium who can talk to the dead. That goes wrong. And it's about the evening that goes, you know, horribly wrong from that point of view. But it's really becoming its own genre of the 80s was much more horrific than the Care Bears led us to believe.
And look at all of this lost media that's coming back to haunt us.
Yeah, so, I mean, there does seem to be a wave of supernatural lost media 80s style.
Very exciting. Benjamin. Speaking of the 80s, one of my favourite things from the 80s is the film David Lynch's Dune.
Ah, so good.
Very so good. One of my favourite things is the character Fade Rautha, who's played by Sting. And he just shows up at the end and goes, "I'm Fade Rautha and I'm going to fight you." And then he jumps around a bit and then he gets stabbed to death.
That's great.
And you know what, Ben? I think one of the reasons that Sting's Fade Rautha basically only shows up in the last 5 minutes, has a duel to the death with Paul, gets stabbed and killed very quickly, is they probably had too much to try to squeeze into one 90-minute film.
Yeah, okay. That is a lot.
Because, you know, Dune is a big book and there's world building and there's lots going on. There's lots of different characters and concepts and you really need time to let it breathe. So how about fucking 5.5 hours?
Yeah, just shove that in your pipe hole.
Shove 5.5 hours in your pipe hole, Benjamin. Shove 5.5 hours of sumptuous French-Canadian Denis Villeneuve scenery into your pipe hole and you fucking sit there and you fucking enjoy it because it's great.
I enjoy this new dark Rats from the Flats style.
This is my new
commentary from you.
This is my new
naming this character.
This is my new very aggressive movie review character. You're going to fucking sit down and you're going to watch Dune 2 and you're going to fucking like every minute of it. Every minute of it. Every one of the 180 plus minutes of it.
So Nidge from Love Hate or Viking from Kin will now be doing our movie reviews from now.
Anyway,
on.
Ben, I saw Dune 2. It's fucking fabulous.
Oh, good. I was. Do you know what? Denis Villeneuve, possibly one of our best directors, Michael. The best, one of the best living directors.
Have you just claimed him, Ben? Have you just claimed him as one of our lads?
We're allowed to do that now, aren't we?
Oh, yeah. Io Debris said it was sound.
Yeah. So he's from now on, he's going to be Denis Villeneuve.
Denis Villeneuve from fucking Mallow, County Cork. Benjamin, anyway. Look,
Mallow, County Cork.
I did myself the favour of watching part one just before I went to see part two. So maybe that's why it felt so long.
Good idea.
But it was a very good idea. Because part two picks up right where part one left off, which is Fan Davidozy in my books. I'm doing a different character now. I'm doing a cheerful children's presenting TV show guy. It's Fan Davidozy in my books, Ben. Because you know how sometimes characters are different between a part one and a part two, or the world feels a little different? Even things like Guardians of the Galaxy 1 and 2, you know, the world and the characters and stuff, they change a little bit in the interim there. And these movies weren't filmed back to back.
No, they weren't. I thought they were.
They weren't.
Oh.
They weren't, no. But they feel like they were.
All right, okay, well that's good, isn't it?
Yeah. Like, if they were back to back, like, say, the two Avengers or the Lord of the Rings, they would have released them in 2021 and 2022, not 2021 and 2024.
Okay, that's very interesting.
But it feels like they were. Like, this one picks up pretty much in exactly the same spot where the last one left off, which is fantastic. So, Benjamin, young Paul Atreides.
Yeah.
His family's been killed.
Yep, no good.
He's out in the desert. He's living every teenage boy's nightmare. He's out in the desert. He's doing a sexy life or death adventure with Zendaya and his mum as well.
And his mum, yeah.
She's just there with him and she's fucking ruining his buzz at every opportunity. So they're running away from Dave Bautista, who's just desperately trying to kill them. And they eventually find their way into the Fremen's sieges, Ben. They're underground cave dwellings.
Yeah.
Now, yeah, exactly. So this is a movie, basically, Ben, where a bunch of comically evil foreign settlers hunt a group of kind of indigenous people who live underground in tunnels and try to wipe them out like rats.
Oh, Michael, they're at it again.
They're at it again, those old Harkonnens, Ben. The comically evil. Who did people think I was talking about? I was talking about the comically evil Harkonnens.
Of course you were.
Because they were the only ones who would do something like that, wouldn't they?
Yeah, there's no way this in any way parallels real life events. No way. Never happened.
So Paul Benjamin essentially becomes a terrorist leader.
Yes, he does, yes.
And, you know, the spoilers, I suppose, in quotation marks here, because this is a book that came out in 1965 and is the basis for science fiction, modern science fiction.
So much.
So, I mean, broadly speaking, we'll try to avoid very specific spoilers until later on in the review, and we will get into them a little bit because we have to talk about some of the changes from the book and some of the unexpected things.
Because there have been.
There have been a few. Mm. Not huge mint. Like, some of it's scene for scene and word for word from the book, which is, you know, great and fabulous. And, look, amazing scenery, flawless special effects, flawless acting. No, the only slightly odd acting is from Javier Bardem, which kind of surprised me a little bit. Stilgar, the character of Stilgar.
Yeah.
And his conversion to the kind of main believer in Paul as the Messiah.
Yeah, Paul's great.
He gets a bit obsessed with Paul.
Oh, does he? Is it uncomfortable?
Anytime Paul does something, he's like, "See, Muad'Dib, I told you."
No, I fucking told you.
Like, Paul does a big fart and everyone starts laughing and he's like, "No, it is prophesied that Muad'Dib would do a big fart." And I'm like, oh, wow, that's very sincere.
That probably would be, in terms of, you know, if you were making prophecies and wanted to cover your ass, you probably could, you know, just do very general human bodily function that would have to happen. You know, Muad'Dib will sweat in the desert, won't sweat in the desert at night.
Or what you could do, Benjamin, is be a sinister cult of all women Machiavellian lunatics who spend 90 generations planting myths and legends and interbreeding bloodlines to create this messiah figure.
Yeah, the witch eugenicists.
Yeah, they're mad.
They're mad. Mentalists. The Bene Gesserit are fucking mental, Michael.
Bene Gesserit are flippin' terrifying. And probably the most terrifying person in this movie is Rebecca Ferguson, who puts on an incredible performance.
We love Rebecca Ferguson here at the podcast, Michael. Fucking Rebecca. Oh, great stuff.
Great stuff. Imagine being terrified of Rebecca Ferguson, Benjamin. Now, you probably would be, obviously, for other
reasons.
Yeah,
no, that would be my default setting, I think, around Rebecca Ferguson.
Hello there, it's nice to meet you. I'm a Swedish actress, Rebecca Ferguson. Oh, Ben's run off. He's gone.
This is my podcast co-host. Oh, he's gone.
He's gone. Oh, he's gone. Well, that's awkward. Did you like being in the movie, Rebecca? Did you have a good time? Benjamin, anyway, look.
Yes.
We're going to have to get into some degree of spoilers, but I will just say, flipping fabulous. Cinema is saved. Cinema is back. Denis Villeneuve has single-handedly brought cinema back. Great news. This is great. The performances are great. The special effects are flawless. The story is captivating and engaging, and you're watching it going, I don't know who the baddies are. Are they the baddies? They're pretty evil, but their ambition seems to be lacking in scope. They just seem to like being evil, whereas these people who are presenting as being the right way, what they seem to be doing is very bad and very sinister. And there's there's no goodies. There's no goodies in this.
So I think that's one of the most interesting things about Dune. There is no savior in Dune. Doesn't exist.
Paul's the worst thing that ever happened.
Yes, he is. The entire premise of Dune is hold no idols. It's the entire premise of the thing is that history, or, you know, factions will try to create myths and legends, and you should resist that, because if you give into it, oh fuck, you're gonna have a bad time.
Benjamin, I thought the entire point, the entire message behind Dune was keep an eye out for what the women are up to. Because they're probably planning something. I reckon it's the women who are planning something. That's what I reckon.
Michael. What? Michael, it's funny when I'm misogynistic, because we've established a kind of, a thing. When you do it's alarming, and people actually start texting me in the Discord being like, is something all right?
I'm not, that's not what I'm saying. That's just the point of this movie. Watch out for those women. They're up to something.
So I think, you know, it's one of the things that gets lost most often. I suppose because Frank Herbert's work has been copied and parodied and distilled. Like, when you look at the very first Star Wars movie, it's just a shit Dune.
Benjamin, we did a whole episode on the things that sprung forth from Dune. Star Wars, Warhammer, Command and Conquer. The list, I wouldn't say the list is endless because I've just given most of it there, but the list is extensive.
And pretty big.
That's only in terms of like globally super famous mega franchises. Going just and reading sci-fi, which I do a decent bit of, even within sci-fi, everything is feels the touch of Dune.
You can't avoid it. The touch of Dune is there. Mm. We should do a documentary called The Touch of Dune, Michael.
We should.
Well, that'd be good. Do you reckon that'd be well worth our time.
Do you reckon we could get it presented for us by British TV anchor Dune Sarpong?
No, I was kind of hoping we get Sting.
Oh, yeah. Sting's touch is tantric, though, so that would probably be uncomfortable. I'd probably leg it.
But come here to me, Michael. That's great, because I can't wait to see it. I'm really looking forward to seeing it. I unfortunately couldn't make it to the Wednesday night cinema club, Michael, and I was devastated. But it does seem to be getting great reviews.
It's getting great reviews, and it's doing gangbusters at the box office. It's fucking great. It's great news, Benjamin. It's great news all around. It's great news for sci-fi. It's great news for cinema. It's great news for genre.
It's great news for Denis Villeneuve from Mallow. He's done great work for a little fella from Mallow. He's just really chugging along. But compared to me, like it is interesting that we say, you know, it is. So there's a big... Can we get into spoilers now?
Okay,
well,
let's get into specifics because, you know, broadly speaking, people know the plot. Well, you know, a lot of people probably don't, but they're not likely to be listening to this. I'd say people who are listening to this broadly know what Dune's about. But from now on, we're going to get into specific detailed spoilers. So skip over this bit. There's time codes.
So there's a rather large change in this from some of the feedback I've seen online. And one of the biggest changes that we're seeing is to Chaney's character. Zendaya plays Chaney, is the Fremen woman. Chaney, who falls in love with Paul Atreides. Throughout the course of the original Dune book. Now, one of the bizarre things that happens towards the end of Dune, to emphasize the point that endless ambition holds no morals, is that Paul Atreides is used as a marriage pawn to gain access to the Emperor's family.
Well, pawn is probably the wrong word, unless you're implying that it's the Bene Gesserit who are doing that. Because it's Paul's idea.
I was heavily implying... Yeah,
it's Paul's idea, but, you know, are any of Paul's ideas really Paul's ideas, or are they Jessica's ideas? Or are Jessica's ideas really Jessica's ideas, or are they the Bene Gesserit? But Paul basically threatens the Emperor, Christopher Walken, the Emperor.
He does.
And says, now you listen here to me, I'm a little French boy, Timothée Chalamet, and I swear to God I'm gonna stab you with my little knife if you don't let me marry your daughter and whatever. One of the things that slightly took me out of this was that the young cast sound like young American. I know Timothée Chalamet is French, but he's an American actor, let's be honest. But the young cast, especially Zendaya and Timothée Chalamet, sound like young Americans.
Uncomfortable for
it. It's a little bit uncomfortable. Anyway, he says, like, I swear to God, I'm going to kill you and blow up all this spice or whatever because you're totally giving bad emperor vibes. But I won't if I can marry your daughter and be in charge and stuff.
Now, in the original book, Michael, Chani is like, yeah, great. Muad'Dib, go for it. This is great. I'll still love you. I'm still there. You know, whatever you got to do to ascend that throne, you're the Muad'Dib, you're the savior, you're going to do it, baby. But in this, apparently, Chani is like, sorry? Yeah.
What? She's like, I'm not having that.
What was all that?
That's, you what now?
What was all that?
Excuse me?
In the desert.
Excuse me, what?
In the desert.
Yeah. So Chani has the, look, Ben, that is modern American values imported into this story. And you could accuse this story of being misogynistic, and I think that large parts of this story are misogynistic. I don't think that the book Dune is misogynistic. It's about a misogynistic society, but the book itself isn't, because in this society there are established rules on royal lineages taking wives and concubines. just like in actual human mm-hmm. history. And a large part of the follow-up series, especially the next book, which isn't great, is about Chani and Princess Irulan dealing with the repercussions of sharing Paul.
One of those books, Dune Messiah, was written specifically by Frank Herbert because people didn't get it in the first book. So a lot of people came away and said, "Ah, Paul Atreides, what a hero." And he was like, "No, no, no." Yeah, and Denis Villeneuve has come out and explained his change to Chani's characters because he has had a few purists come at him and say, "How could you do this? That's not Chani's character." But Denis Villeneuve has come out and said very clearly, you know, when he was reading the books and the history around the books and, you know, doing his research, Dune Messiah was written specifically to underline the point that there is not a hero in Dune. They're not heroes, they're not saviors, it's not what's happening. And he said that he wanted to find a way to bring that into his movie, so he made the change there so that he could underline those points. So essentially what Chani is in this is Frank Herbert's underlining of his
own
message.
Look, lads, everyone seems to be going along with this, so here's a character whose voice represents 21st century ideals, like wrapped up a little bit in Fremen mythology. But Chani in this book is very much a modern Earth human woman. And good, she's like, "I don't agree with any of this. This is all bad. Everyone stop." And everyone's like, "Shush now, Chani. This is not the time nor the place for it." So I see that point. I see the idea of giving one character who represents the outside viewpoint or the modern Earth viewpoint of the viewer and saying, "Look, someone agrees with you that this is wrong and bad."
Yeah.
But I don't know if it was necessarily necessary. I don't know if that decision will age beautifully, because I think having everyone row in behind it is also kind of, maybe it takes a bit more cognition then on the viewer to go, "I don't agree with this, actually. I know all the characters do, but I think this is terrible."
So it's kind of interesting. As I said, I haven't seen the movie, so I will reserve full judgment until I've seen the movie on the change and stuff. But one of the interesting things that's taking place on the internet at the minute, Michael, is the observation of the decline of media literacy skills in the general population, specifically in younger generations than millennial.
Oh, that covers us, so we're sound.
Because we're now
sound, Ben.
We're sound. We're good lads. And that's a great bit of critical thinking, Michael. You've just underlined the fact that I may have misguided the viewers into trusting us as reliable narrators. When we might not be. We might not be. That's a false fallacy. It's a fallacy.
Is that like a double negative?
It's a fallacy. It's like a double negative. We are unstoppable. We are the false fallacies. That'd be a great punk name if we ever get around to starting our punk band, Michael. We'll call ourselves that. But anyway, come here to me. There's a big debate at the minute around the decline in media literacy, and it's coming from a very unusual place, Michael.
Twitter.
Which is Helldivers 2, the video game.
Oh yeah, go on.
Yeah, yeah. So Helldivers 2 is...
Ben, can I suggest we maybe talk about this next week? Because that sounds like a fascinating time.
I think that's a great idea, Michael, because we don't have an episode for next week.
Okay.
So I think that's a very good idea.
Fabulous.
Ladies and gentlemen, you'll have to tune in next week to hear about our fascinating observation of the decline of cultural media literacy skills in the 21st century through the lens of Helldivers 2, the video game.
Very good and exciting. How exciting. Anyway, Benjamin, there are some substantial changes to this from the book. I'm going to go into them a little bit. One of them, and perhaps the biggest one, is that in the book, the original book, Paul Atreides and Chani have a child, Leto.
Yes, they do.
And Leto is killed by the Harkonnens in a raid. And, I mean, you couldn't make the changes that you have made to Chani and have that happen and have her be kind of cool with it.
This is grand.
Yeah, she'd be like, this is
fine.
And also then in the book, Paul has a sister, Aaliyah, who is
does.
Who is going to be played by by Anya Taylor-Joy. But in this, she never quite gets bored. She, like, the events of the movie are truncated considerably compared to the book. I don't remember specifically how long it is in the book, but the events of the book are probably about 10 years, maybe more. And in the movie, more, it's think, about but, six yeah. or 7 months. So that's the kind of biggest change is the... No children are born in this, whereas in the book, substantial amounts of children are born and either killed or turn out to be really weird.
Yeah, Aaliyah is really weird.
Really weird.
She's really weird. She's a sentient baby at one point, isn't she, in the book?
Yeah, she's an absolute... So I think that's one of the reasons they did it, was rather than having her pop out of her mother and be like, "What's up, gang? It's me. It's your girl, Aaliyah." Rather than having that happen, which would be just unjustifiable, they have her in utero communicating with Rebecca Ferguson. Which lets Rebecca Ferguson do some great acting, though, where like we don't hear the voice until towards the end. So it's just Rebecca Ferguson being terrible and weird and saying, "She wants to know why you're looking at me like that." And everyone's going like, "Who does?" And then she rubs her belly.
Who are you talking about?
And it's like, "Oh no, you've gone mad." But Rebecca Ferguson is amazing. Anyway, Benjamin, look, it's great. There are substantial changes from the book. Some of them for the better. Some of them we'll see. Let's give it the benefit of the doubt and time and see if they hold up. But fucking best film of the last couple of years by an easy margin and well worth going to see.
Oh, okay, right. Well, I'll probably check that out, Michael. Speaking of horrific things that make you uncomfortable, like sentient babies, Michael.
Yeah.
I got through issues 41 to 45 of the Sabretooth War.
Rough.
In the new Wolverine series.
Rough going. Some...
Fucking hell.
Some of the most upsetting stuff that have happened in comics. And comics can be pretty upsetting. For example, we read The Boys.
We did. Awful. Never read The Boys, ladies and gentlemen. It's always worth saying.
Don't read it. Just watch the show and forget about the comic.
Yeah, so... There's some interesting stuff happening here. So this is part of a new comic event from Marvel called the Sabretooth War. Mm. And it picks up... It runs parallel to the storyline of the Fall of X, which is the end of Krakoa and the Mutant Paradise that was established 2 years ago, 3 years
ago? More even, I think.
More even. But anyway, it's the end of Paradise. Paradise Lost, essentially, is the era of the X-Men that we're in. And it's written by none other than Victor Lavelle, Michael, who we heard of previously on this podcast for writing the novel for The Changeling, which then got turned into the Apple Plus TV series.
Which we've completely forgot to watch.
That we completely forgot to watch and is lost to the annals of streaming history. But he's writing this, Michael. And fuck me, he's mean.
Oh, there's some very mean shit happening. So, Benjamin, sorry to cut across you. The reason that this is happening, of course, is it's all part of a big plan because it's a very important year this year.
It is.
As I'm sure you're aware. This year is Wolverine's 50th birthday.
As a fictional character, not in continuity. Yeah.
In continuity, he's much older or younger, depending on which version you're talking about. But it's the 50th anniversary of the character of Wolverine. He was first published in 1974, would you fucking believe?
That's mental.
Mad shit altogether.
Old man Logan. All the way down. See that? See that kind of razor sharp kind of commentary, ladies and gentlemen? Because there's a famous character in the comics called Old Man Logan. If you like that, ladies and gentlemen, give us a review wherever you listen. Of course, Michael, that would make it his birthday of sorts.
Oh, go on.
Yeah, and that's... Michael, that opens up the door for why this storyline event is taking place. Because within the Marvel Comics continuity and history, Sabretooth is a bit of a bollocks.
Benjamin, he might be the worst.
He might just be the worst. Michael, he has a tradition within the comics. And that tradition is he makes Logan's life a living hell on his birthday for 24 hours every year.
Like a real prick. Like a real secondary school bully.
He's a real prick. He targets Wolverine once a year on his birthday and does horrific things to him.
He blew up his motorbike.
Yes.
In one comic. I mean, the level of horrific kind of depends on the writers, if we're being honest.
Depends on the writers. He murdered his wife of sorts at one point, Michael. The origin of this tradition, of Sabretooth's tradition, actually came to us in 1989, would you believe?
Yeah, I would.
And it was none other than Chris Claremont, X-Men writer extraordinaire, who's into whips and chains and all those fucking things.
Not really surprising, then, that he gave us a character who's an unrepentant sadist.
An unrepentant sadist. And he is the man who really hammered into the Sabretooth, Wolverine, Tooth and Claw, on-site kind of rivalry between the pair. So Sabretooth didn't originate in X-Men comics at all.
He's an Iron Fist baddie.
He's an Iron Fist baddie from 1974, Michael. So it's also his 50th birthday this year. And it's... Chris Claremont was writing the Iron Fist run at the time and was like, I'm just going to introduce Wolverine's greatest rival in this comic, and I'll build it out over the next couple of decades. And that's what he did. And one of the things I think that often gets lost on fan forums or Twitter or on Facebook, you know, when we have our famous, you know, who'd win in a fight thing, it depends on the writer. Chris Claremont set out the stipulation of who'd win in a fight between Wolverine and Sabretooth. And originally, when he made this statement, it was sometime in the late 80s, early 90s. And he said, in their whole life, Logan has never defeated Sabretooth in a knockdown, drag out, kill or kill or be killed berserker fight. By the same token, on every one of his birthdays, Sabretooth has always managed to find him, no matter where Logan was or what he was doing, and come within an inch of killing him for no other reason than to remind him that he could.
Wouldn't it be great if, like, Logan was on his birthday, he was in the Shi'ar Star Empire? And he was, like, fighting against the Shi'ar Imperial Guard. And Sabretooth goes, oh, shit. How am I supposed to get there?
Fuck.
I guess I have to find a galactic transport. But it's worth it to blow up his motorbike and whiz off on a jetpack.
It's worth it. It's so fucking worth it. So this was established in a famous run during the... We talked about it about 2 or 3 weeks ago, Michael, during the Madripoor patch run of Wolverine in the 80s, written by Chris Claremont. He wrote a standalone story called 24 Hours, and it was Wolverine and Madripoor on his birthday, and he was a ball of anxiety because he knew Sabretooth was going to pop out of the woodwork and fuck him up, basically. That's because that's what's happened on every birthday. Now, at the time, Michael, this was mind-blowing because this was before we had any inkling of Wolverine's origin as a character. He was still kind of a mysterious loner, and we didn't know everything about him. And Chris Claremont would take the opportunity every once in a while, Michael, to pen a story that gave us a little taste of Wolverine's past.
Just a little amuse-bouche. Of course, Benjamin...
Yeah.
The kind of comics are fluid, weird, fluid things, and like Wolverine is now such an established character, but like these two characters were introduced in the fucking freewheeling 1970s. And in the 70s you could introduce a character with an idea in mind and then change your mind and then drop a few hints but then go, nah, actually Mr. Sinister isn't an imaginary psychic projection of an orphan boy who created the most terrifying villain he could. He's actually an English biochemist named Nathaniel Essex. You could do that sort of shit.
He's a real dick.
And they did that with Wolverine and Sabretooth because they toyed with the idea of introducing Sabretooth as Wolverine's dad at one stage.
They did that loads. Yeah. And his brother, his dad. And then it became another sadistic way for Sabretooth to fuck with Wolverine because Wolverine didn't have his memories intact. Whereas it's heavily implied that Sabretooth has all of his memories of every encounter he's had with Wolverine.
But what you've presented there is the retcon. Because when Sabretooth was telling Wolverine he was his dad, or dropping hints he was his dad, and then they decided that he wasn't, then it was like, he was fucking with him because he's a dick.
Because he's a dick. And Michael, Victor Lavelle has obviously read into this tradition. It actually wasn't a thing for many, many years until about 2018, Michael, during the Weapon X run, where Old Man Logan was the central character of the Weapon X team.
Go on.
And they reintroduced it in a perfectly named one-shot standalone story called Blow Up Your Candles, which I really enjoyed. And it was essentially Old Man Logan having to take on Sabretooth, who hunted both Logans. Or at that time, Logan was dead. Earth 616's Logan was dead, and Old Man Logan had taken his spot.
Was he dead, or was he in an adamantium cocoon?
He was in the adamantium cocoon, probably. But Sabretooth saw no reason that he shouldn't have his birthday fun at the expense, so he hunted down Old Man Logan instead. And there we got a really good look at, you know, Sabretooth versus Wolverine in World War One, and Sabretooth versus Wolverine in Edo era period Japan. You know, there were all kinds of things. And Michael, it's the scene from a movie that you watched.
I watched X-Men Origins Wolverine this week, and I tell you what, interesting, very interesting,
interesting,
very interesting film. As a standalone film, a lot better than I remember it being. Much better than Madame Web, for example. It has... It has a start, a middle, and an end. And the things that happen broadly make sense. Too many things happen, and a lot of them have stupid reasons to happen. But the central story about two bros who grow apart due to war, and one of them turns into a psycho, and the other one turns into a weird Superman-type Ma and Pa Kent character. Other than it butchers X-Men lore, that's great. The relationship between Wolverine and Sabretooth in this movie is fabulous. Now, they took a liberty. So they kind of did the X-Men... They kind of did Wolverine Origins... Wolverine's origin from that. So Benjamin, once again, you were probably too young for this, but Wolverine's origin was revealed in 2001-2002 in the comic series Wolverine Origin, or Origins.
Yes.
And I was around for that. I was reading comics. I was an adult man, and the excitement about that was unreal. Wolverine was easily the most popular character in comics. You had a generation who'd grown up watching the X-Men animated show from Fox, and Wolverine was everything. And revealing his origin was this amazing story. So the origin comic's kind of rubbish. Mm. But it reveals that Wolverine, rubbish.
It's awful. I reread it for this week.
Absolute fucking waste of it. But the kind of little twist where Wolverine turns out to be the sickly boy James Hewlett rather than Dog Logan is... You know, that's the iconic twist of that comic. And the movie takes the same twist, but rather than Dog Logan being an unrelated character, makes him Victor Creed, makes him Sabretooth. And it makes them, in the movie universe at least, canonically half-brothers. And two pair of pricks.
Yeah, two prickaroonies.
But they do a team up at the end because they meet someone worse. Because the whole plot goes fucking off the rails.
Oh man, absolutely mental. One of the things that I always loved, Liev Schreiber, great fucking Sabretooth.
Very good Sabretooth. Now, I like Tyler Mayne's look.
Okay. And that was, the big eyes.
The big eyes and the long hair and the... I love that Jim... Like, I love Sabretooth's look. Sabretooth's a cool looking character.
He's
one of my favourite... He's one of my favourite action figures, Ben. I've got him here, look.
He's a big inverted V, Michael.
He's just a big heckin' chonker. Look at him.
And he always has the mane. The mane is always the best bit, the fur-lined collar thing. It's great. But
I love Sabretooth's look. He's a cool-looking character. And that was something Liev Schreiber was missing.
Yeah.
Because he was a typical early or mid-2010s man in a trench coat.
Yes, we'll put him in a trench coat and we'll give him nails and fangs. That'll be good.
Yeah.
One of the things, Michael, that I forgot, I suppose, is just how savage Sabretooth is. And Victor Lavelle's new run really drives that home. Jesus fucking Christ. I read the first issue of this, Michael, and it made me queasy.
He's got an army of himself with no heads.
Yeah, so this is one of my favourite batshit balls-to-the-wall moves that I've ever seen. So, In the X-Men universe, they got their own island. Krakoa became an X-Men's paradise. Fucking Charles Xavier decided to lean into his fucking savior complex, and he does it. He fixes the world for mutant kind. He gives them a haven. He gives them a place. And then for the next couple of years, we got stories that were great investigations of utopia, because the question was, what do you have to do to maintain paradise? What do you have to give up? What ethics do you have to surrender? What difficult choices do you have to make? And one of the difficult choices that the Xtopia has to make is that there are certain people that threaten the peace and calmness of this utopia. And one of those people is deemed to be Victor Creed, Sabretooth. They all take a look at him and go, no, he's an absolute unrepentant bastard, and he will fuck it up at some point for us.
Get rid of him.
And they throw him down the pit of Krakoa. Now, I don't understand, or I couldn't get the grips of, how he became a multidimensional being from that point on. But he does. He starts to traverse dimensions. And in the beginning, he does exactly what you would expect Sabretooth to do. He hunts down Logans and he kills them. And then...
He's a bit of a prick,
let's be honest. And then he has an even better idea, which is, oh, well, Logan's not much of a fight, but I am. I'm fucking deadly. So he goes around killing himself. And Earth 616 Victor Creed seems to become Sabretooth Prime through sheer law of the jungle, Darwinian, I'm the toughest and strongest, I'm in charge.
He's the biggest prick.
He's the biggest prick. And what we're introduced to, Michael, in issue 41 and part one of the Sabretooth War is he's decapitated a bunch of Sabretooths and turned them into fucking headless Sabretooth droids.
Yeah.
And it's fucking mental.
Benjamin, look, if I could do interdimensional travel, I think, like, it wouldn't be on the bottom of my list of things to do.
That's the way to do it. I really enjoyed it, but... he is a bastard, Michael. There's a horrific scene at the start of this where they take on Quentin Quire, who's an Omega-level telepath and telekinetic mutant.
Yeah, Kid Omega.
Kid Omega. And Sabretooth and the lads devour him as a pack. They literally eat him alive. And it's awful.
Very upsetting.
Very upsetting, Michael. And then he does a second act. He gets rid of Dakin from Wolverine's son. And he spells out happy birthday using his son's body parts.
Yeah, very upsetting. One of the most upsetting comic panels in a while. And the reason we kind of ended up looking into this was that comic panel started doing the rounds and everyone was like, look at this. This isn't great, is it?
Fucking awful, man. But Victor Lavelle really understands Sabretooth's character. Sabretooth is a sadistic, joy-taking bastard. And he's just the worst. There's some really bizarre scenes in the third part of this. And spoilers for the run from here on out. That part one is pretty standard stuff. But spoilers for part three of this. It turns out that Quentin Quire's head is kept alive in stasis so that Wolverine can access his powers. And he has these bizarre dialogues with Quentin Quire's head full of weird pop culture references. For example, the code name he's designated Wolverine is Tiny Dancer.
Oh, that's an Elton John song.
It's an Elton John song. But it's weird. Victor Lavelle has a unique talent for creating this dramatic, over-the-top sadist. Mm. And it works really well, but it's so uncomfortable to read.
Horrible stuff.
Horrible stuff. It's a phenomenal tradition, and I think this comic has its flaws. I think it's straying into its midway spread now, where it's all getting a bit too superhero-y. But the first three parts of this are a gut punch and an excellent redefining of why Wolverine and Sabretooth fucking hate each other.
Yeah, because Sabretooth's a real prick. Sabretooth, then, one of the iconic fights of comics in the 90s was when Sabretooth mauled Psylocke.
Yeah.
And that was like... the comics these days, well, comics in the 90s were a bit gentler. They were a bit edgier, but you wouldn't see people being eaten alive by a pack of headless saber-tooths. But like that Sabretooth from when I started reading comics was always like, sure, he's not the biggest, he's not the most powerful, he's not a global threat. But when he shows up, it's like, oh no.
This guy. If you go one-to-one with Sabretooth, you're fucked.
Yeah.
And initially, I didn't really see the threat of this, because I used to have the same view of Sabretooth, where I'd be like, he's just a bigger Wolverine. Like, surely you could take him. But this really defines him as, oh no, like, one-on-one against Sabretooth, anyone is fucked. Because he is better than Wolverine. He is stronger, more ferocious. His healing factor is 10 times the healing factor that Wolverine has. And he's gonna fuck you up. And what the big threat of this is, he has an army of himself.
With no heads, though.
With no heads. So it's fucking terrifying. It's great stuff from Victor Lavelle. Well done you. Well done you, Victor. But the artist on it is doing a phenomenal job as well. We're just out of time, ladies and gentlemen. I'm getting that classic thing. But I wanted to give one little shout out to the artist of the Sabretooth War. Lionel Yu is doing all the covers, which is always great. And now...
Yeah. Who is it?
Now...
Yeah, who is
Michael,
it?
Fuck you. Fuck you! No! No! Corey Smith and Jeff Shaw are doing some of the things. And it is being hailed by many critics as the most violent Wolverine story ever. And it might be. It's pretty fucking grim.
Yeah. Awful stuff.
It's pretty grim. I also found out, Michael, in researching this, Victor Lavelle... please tell me I got his name right. I'm just suddenly... Yeah, no, Victor Lavelle. Victor Lavelle, sorry. Okay. Not Lavelle, Lavelle. But he's been writing Sabretooth for a while. He's been writing Sabretooth since 2022. And he does a lot of stuff. He does a lot of solo runs for Sabretooth. So this is his kind of moment to let the work he's been doing on the character shine, which is very interesting.
Cool.
Good stuff.
Stuff altogether.
Well, ladies and gentlemen.
What?
Who do you think could win in a fight? Wolverine or Sabretooth?
Sabretooth.
Let us know. Sabretooth. Yeah, that's the answer. It's the only one answer. There's only one answer. I might put a poll up during the week where I only give one option. And it's Sabretooth. But yeah, let us know in a few different places. You can find us on the interwebs at www.seomrabeag.com. SEOMRABEAG.com.
I mean, it's tiny room in Irish, kind of.
Kind of, sort of, a little bit. You can find us... on our other website at sureluxurelistenpodcast.acast.com.
That's the podcast website.
Yeah, we're up there on Instagram at sureluxurelistenpodcast.
We are. Are we in jail or are we out of jail?
We're still struggling. Okay. Instagram keeps changing its algorithm, ladies and gentlemen. And I'll be honest, I'm a lot grayer this week than I was 3 weeks ago. but come here to me. The other thing that you can find us on is Threads, because we're up on that now as well. We're doing all right on Threads, actually. People seem to be finding us, even though we don't post on Threads much. But we'll start. If that's what people want, we'll start.
You can start. It's a cesspit.
You do, and you're a man of taste and caliber, mm-hmm. except for when it comes to podcast co-hosts. Yeah, but look, nobody's perfect. You can also find us on at Sure Look Sure Listen on TikTok, where we're doing very well, Michael. TikTok is our fastest growing social network, or we're up there on YouTube. We can check out our shorts. Yeah, you can join us in a week's time, ladies and gentlemen, where we'll be taking a look at the decline of media literacy through the lens of Helldivers 2.
Ooh.
Which will be a fun episode.
How exciting. Or maybe a few more other things. Do I have to play Helldivers 2, Ben? Because I will.
Well, I might do it as well. So if we both commit to playing a bit of Helldivers 2, but we don't have to. I don't. It's quite an investment for a bit. And we don't get paid, ladies and gentlemen, to do this podcast. Some people have been throwing comments our way, being like, if this is your job, guys, come on. Come on, fix up. It's like, this is not our
job. Who's doing that?
How dare
you? That's good, though.
There's a few comments. There's a few comments on TikTok and YouTube where people are like, come on, guys. If you're going to charge people. And we're like, no, we don't. This is all free.
This costs us money.
This costs us a lot of money at this point. But anyway, come here to me. Ladies and gentlemen, join us then. And then the week after that, we'll be doing a classic Irishman's Spas because it's coming up to Paddy's Day and we have to. We're legally obligated
by Big Patrick's Day. I guess.
By Big Paddy. Yeah. Yeah. All right, that's it.
Wrap it up, Ben. That was a bit rambling.
Bye.
Bye, bye. Bye. It's over now. It's actually over. Unless we're just going to chat a bit more, are we? It's over.